Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. We welcome you again to Extension 720.
Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. Hello to all. This is Milton Rosenberg.
We'll talk about that tonight on Extension 720.
Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm your host, Justin Kaufman. I missed you terribly. It's been 2 weeks since we've been on, since spring break, which was lovely, by the way. Both Pete and I went out to California, not together, but found ourselves in the same state. And of course, we've been out because of White Sox baseball. But the good news is that we were able to take some extra time to go out, find some stories around our theme. Tonight, let's explore the environment. Put together a loose theme around Earth Week. What better way to tell the stories of climate change than through the people who live it, who are affected by it, and who are trying to fix it? We'll talk with two of the Democrat representatives from the Illinois delegation who are speaking out on the proposed budget cuts for the EPA, veteran Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky from the North Shore and freshman Congressman Sean Casten from the North and West Suburbs. Do they support the Green New Deal? We'll find out. And if you believe that the cuts of the EPA are inconsequential or even necessary, listen in on my conversation with longtime environmental activist Cheryl Johnson. Johnson runs the People for Community Justice at Altgeld Gardens. The far south side public housing project is called the Toxic Donut.
It was unbearable at one particular time. You knew when you coming down the Bishop Ford Expressway that you coming towards Altgeld Gardens because the smell was that horrible. Mm.
Cheryl's mother, Hazel Johnson, was one of the first to push for clean air in her community and even coined the term environmental racism. Cheryl has kept her mother's legacy going by working with the city to bring their own solar panel farm to Altgeld Gardens. I went down there to talk with Cheryl about her family's life's work. We'll talk with that coming up a little bit later in the 7 o'clock hour. Anya Sastry is starting out her career as an activist. The high school student from Barrington is one of the primary voices of the U.S. Youth Climate Strike. They want any Democrat that's on the ticket in 2020 to sign a pledge to prioritize climate change. And so far, seems to be working. It doesn't just stop there. How about urban agriculture? Erica Allen and Urban Growers Collective are teaching agriculture and farming to inner city youth, creating food and a safe place for communities. And goats. Got lots of sounds of goats. That's coming up. Matt Weschler has made a beautiful documentary called Sustainable. You may have seen it. It's on Netflix. Been on there for a while. Looks at the history of industrial agriculture and how independent farms today are not only staying in business, but creating new markets. And we head to Little Village to continue our neighborhood tours, to a neighborhood that has seen its share of industry and industrial waste. But a new day may be dawning for the Southwest Side neighborhood as parks and green spaces are competing with abandoned lots and factories. And we can't leave out innovation, right? It's a great idea. A Roomba for the river. What do you think of that? A nonprofit wants you to volunteer to operate a trash robot on the Chicago River. A new way to clean up our waterways? Is that all of it? Did I miss anything? That's a show. We're calling it Who's Gonna Save the World? All that tonight, Extension 720. But first, this is a show featuring stories around the environment. But more than that, more than a radio show on climate change, it's about who's going to step up and save the world. It doesn't have to be Iron Man or Guardians of the Galaxy. It could be anyone who just wants to make it right. It could be any of my guests tonight, Cheryl Johnson, Erica Allen, or Nick Wesley. It could be our lawmakers like New York Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Louisiana Republican Garrett Graves. Or it could be anyone who helped clean up a park or plant a garden on Earth Day. It's about standing up. It's the foundation in which our country was built. Our forefathers were standing up for themselves. Taxation without representation. From the tyranny of the British. Standing up for what was right. It's the whole idea of the United States of America. The whole idea of a Bill of Rights. You remember those?
One. The right to employment in America once and for all by guaranteeing a job at a living wage for every American willing and able to work. Two, The right to a living wage, to a safe workplace, to fair trade, and to organize a union at work without fear of firing or reprisal. 3. The right to quality health care. 4. The right to a tuition-free, quality, federally funded, locally controlled public education system. 5. The right to decent, affordable housing. 6. The right to accessible and affordable utilities. 7. The right to fair taxation that's distributed in proportion to ability to pay.
Ah, the Bill of Rights. And if you're paying attention, those weren't the true Bill of Rights. They were the economic Bill of Rights that are in the new Green New Deal. This week, that's the same, yeah, the same deal that has become a political mudbath. But in the middle of all that political posturing, those rights laid out right there by President Jefferson, Clay Jenkinson, by the way. Go see him with King John at Tivoli, May 18th. But what he wrote, those rights, they seem right. Inalienable, even. This week, the USA Today celebrated Earth Day by publishing a big cover story on climate change. It had all the doomsday scenarios. But the main takeaway is that some scientists believe that we can reverse climate change without having to change our lifestyles. As they say it, a future won't be mud huts and gruel, but clean air and warm homes. So to borrow from FDR again with climate change, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. But this issue can't be one that has us frozen in our footsteps. But you know who's breaking out? Who's breaking out of those footsteps? Young people. They aren't petrified about what could go wrong like you and I are. They're leading the charge. And maybe we should follow. But we need more than a televised town hall, more than a midterm election. We need a common will. We need to recognize the wrongs of the past and the rights we should have in the future. That doesn't sound like a new deal. It sounds more like a declaration. And we know a little about declarations, don't we? It's Extension 720 tonight. Stay with us. Extension 720 tonight, stories of environmental justice, 720 WGN. It's Extension 720 and 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Who's going to save the world? The theme tonight here on Extension 720. Let's start with a quick conversation with two members of our congressional delegation. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky and Congressman Sean Casten both have come together to protest the proposed cuts to the EPA in the 2020 budget proposed by the White House. President Trump is looking to cut 31% from the Environmental Regulatory Agency. Schakowsky and Casten have both been strong advocates for climate change policy in Congress. Casten ran on climate change as one of his main campaign issues, which in part helped him defeat longtime Republican Peter Roskam. But now the campaigns are over. And the country is looking for this Congress to effect change when it comes to the environment. A new study polling Iowa Democrats before the Iowa caucuses shows that 91% of voters support the Green New Deal. So where do two of Illinois' biggest proponents on the environment stand? We caught up with them at a rally earlier this week, Federal Plaza. So we're down here at Federal Plaza, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, Congressman Sean Casten. First off, the budget that has been proposed by President Trump, it does look to cut some of the EPA. Why is that important to you?
Well, yesterday was Earth Day, a day where most of us acknowledge that we are facing a crisis right now in the environment, and the budget should reflect that. Of course, instead, the Trump administration is going in the opposite direction as fast as it can. And so the good news is that the Democrats control the House of Representatives, which means that we have considerable control over that budget. So we're going to be looking at the plan that could reduce staff, put in lackeys of the White House to oversee what's going on here and to reverse the direction. This is part of his plan to pull out of the Paris Accord, to get rid of the Clean Power Plant, to allow toxins to be admitted into the air. Last year was an increase in the amount of carbon that was in the atmosphere, an increase of over 3% in the United States of America under Trump. I mean, we have to face this crisis now. There's a sense of urgency. Our new members bring that with us, with them to our caucus. And this is an unacceptable plan. We'll fight it all the way.
Congressman Kasten, you're one of the new faces in Congress, and you ran on this platform of taking on climate change. What does it mean to get a budget from the White House that is going to be a cut, a significant cut to the EPA?
Well, look, what's unambiguously clear is that the Trump administration does not understand economics or environmental science. We have a massive economic opportunity in front of us to reduce CO2 emissions and grow the economy. And I know that because I've done it. I spent 16 years running companies that profitably reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We were consistently frustrated by how many United States laws got in the way of doing more of that. But United States laws can be changed. What we have instead is an administration that violates the guidance that one of my wisest board members told me once, that he said, the only judgment that matters on us in this life is how our grandchildren will judge us. And we've only got one planet. On Earth Day, on every day, it's the only planet we got. And to sit there and look at a budget that is going to slash enforcement in Region 5 by 15%, to slash Great Lakes restoration by 90%. This is the program that we depend on to have clean water in Chicago. The cuts to the state loan revolving fund are greater in Illinois than almost any other state on a percentage basis. I don't know whether that is out of malevolence or incompetence, but we are going to fight this every step of the way, and I would like to thank all the voters for ensuring that after the last election, Trump's legislative agenda is basically dead on arrival in the House. And now we've got to get some adult supervision to get back to the point where we can do what's best for everybody on both environmental and economic matters.
You've seen it in the Capitol building and in both chambers, a lot of talk about climate change and global warming and what we can do about it. We saw the Green New Deal that was put out. For you to be one of the veterans in the House and representing Illinois, do you back a plan, the Green New Deal? Do you back a big concept to change the way we think of climate change?
You know, I am a co-sponsor of the Green New Deal, which is a resolution that sets a vision of what we can do to make our planet sustainable in a very comprehensive way. And that's a good thing. But more than that, right now I am on the Environment Subcommittee, and I was at a hearing where the Republicans, same old story, deniers, bad for jobs. And I want to tell the Republicans that to remember that everything is on the record, and they might want to not embarrass their children, their grandchildren, and be on the wrong side of history and be on the wrong side of science.
You've been dealing with the other side for your whole career. I mean, what is the impetus? What is their theories? What keeps them from joining you in trying to tackle this huge issue?
The same old story of somehow you have to pick between the environment and jobs and the economy, and Sean has said that's completely false. Our future economically is in clean energy and exporting those things around the world, being the leaders. And that's where the jobs are, and that's where they will be. And they continue fighting the last battle, which is loss because it is killing us.
Congressman Kasten, you were on with me on the Steve Cochran Show not too long ago, and you kind of said that the Green New Deal was kind of choking other things that could be done in the meantime for climate change. Are you behind the Green New Deal, or do you think that things need to be changed?
So, look, in order to do climate policy right, you have to have two things. You have to, number one, have a recognition that the urgency of action is vastly greater than the action that we have dedicated to this thus far. And the Green New Deal has brought that urgency, which is awesome, and we would not be having the kind of conversation we're having now without it. You also have to have an appreciation for the complexity of our system and the fact that, you know, with agriculture and healthcare, our energy system is probably the most heavily regulated part of our society. and has an awful lot of unintended consequences of well-intentioned regulation. And the concern I've had with the Green New Deal is that I think it's failed to have that complexity in it and recognize it. But the support is great, and you know, you wouldn't expect something led by sort of the activist end to necessarily have all that sophistication, but I'm delighted to be working with Jan and all her leadership and the expertise that does exist on the Energy and Commerce Committee to take this sort of inspiration and then say, okay, now let's get down to brass tacks and get this done. And let's do it in a way that recognizes that what really matters is getting CO2 down, that goal trumps all path-based regulation, and that at the end of the day, everything we do to reduce fossil fuel combustion means we spend less money on fossil fuel, which means we have more money in our pockets. That is economically stimulative, with one exception. If you make your money by extracting fossil fuel from the ground, that's not in your interest. The good news is that most of the economy depends on turning raw energy into finished goods and services. We have more people employed in this country as bakers than we do as coal miners. Bakers have an economic interest in turning fuel and flour into bread. Coal miners have an economic interest in pulling fuel out of the ground. We can grow our economy by making ourselves more efficient, but we gotta really focus on doing that and stop this false dichotomy between the environment and our economy.
On the Select Committee?
Yeah, I am on the Select Committee on the climate crisis as well, and I'm really looking forward to trying to lead some policies on that front.
My last question, I'll let you guys go. Congresswoman, you look at the numbers and the polling, and a large majority of Americans want something to be done on climate change. They believe in it, and they believe that the government needs to do something. Are you confident that the Democrats in the House and the politicians in general and lawmakers in D.C. can get something done?
I really do feel confident. You know, we passed some climate bills and getting rid of CO2 the last time that Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker of the House. But a lot has changed in those years. The American people have come to understand how critical this issue is. And I do believe if the House takes a very strong and aggressive position and action and bills that pass, that the senators, especially those who are up for re-election, are going to need to follow suit.
Great. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky and Congressman Sean Casten talking about climate change and the Green New Deal. We'll continue tonight's theme as we take a break and get a new news update with Don Kleppen coming up here on 720 WGN. Thanks, Don. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. Coming up, we heard Jan Schakowsky and Sean Casten talk about climate change, and the Democratic presidential candidates are talking it up. But some youth activists want to make sure that the talk, walk the walk. They're asking that all Democratic candidates pledge their support for a specific climate change debate. No other questions, just about their plans for climate change. So that's coming up. We're going to talk with one of the youth activists that is putting that pledge together coming up here from Barrington, Illinois. So we'll talk with her coming up in this hour. But right now, we continue our theme tonight with who's going to save the world, talking about climate change and when it comes to Chicago environmental justice. You don't have to go far to realize that Chicago has several cases of contaminants and pollutants that have seeped into our land, air, and water. Just this week, the Chicago Park District's replacing or removing water fountains just because of lead. Or look to the southeast side's fight over Petco particles in the air, or take a trip to Gary on a windy day. But if you really want to get to know how industry and pollution has affected communities, take a close look at Altgeld Gardens. The far south side public housing project has stood 115 years at 130th and Ellis. It's one of the first ever public housing sites in the United States. It's also famous for being the place where then-community organizer Barack Obama got his start. But Altgeld Gardens is also known by another name, the Toxic Donut. Surrounded by industry, a sewage plant, and landfills, the air quality alone has been deemed unsuitable, hazardous. High levels of asthma and respiratory illness have plagued this community, and for years, nobody cared. Hazel Johnson cared. A resident of Altgeld Gardens, Hazel stood up. She organized an office called the People for Community Justice after her husband died of lung cancer in 1969, and her kids were having skin and respiratory problems of their own. Johnson fought back, and the activist is known to be the woman who started the environmental justice movement. She died back in 2011.
Today, her daughter, Cheryl Johnson, runs the office out of our Altgeld Gardens and has continued her mom's legacy by working with the city to get a solar energy farm put in where one of the factories once stood. We took a trip down to the public housing project to visit Cheryl, talk about her accomplishment, but also her life living in the toxic donut.
My name is Cheryl Johnson. You're in Altgeld Gardens, and you're in my office known as People for Community Recovery.
How did you get into this work?
By force. And when I said force, my mother's had seven kids, and she said I was always a problematic kid, so she always kept me doing stuff with her. So my mother founded this organization, and I was working at a federal laboratory, so I was always doing her administrative work, mm-hmm. making her flyers. So I've really been engaged in this office since when I was 22 years old.
And your mother is considered to be really one of the champions, if not the founders, of the movement of environmental justice and really pointing out environmental racism in this city. Altgeld Garden sits in the middle of what they once called a toxic donut. We just came from talking with Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, Congressman Sean Casson, all talking about climate change and things that Congress can do to and the EPA can do to help families and to help Americans.
Mm-hmm.
For you to be in this position and to be part of a family that has championed environmental justice and taken on environmental racism, what's your take on Congress, the government, and others trying to help out your area?
It's a long time coming. It took my mother 25 years to see the fruit of her labor. When you talk about climate change, she always talked about the carbon emission had impact the ozone, but she said you're going to see a change in the weather pattern. You know, so she always talked about those things. Considering that my mother never had a background in none of this, and to see that a lot of policies and program is being implemented 30 years ago when she was advocating for that. So it's phenomenal, you know.
The issues that you faced in Altgeld Gardens and many communities in Chicago, primarily in the South and West Sides, have faced when it comes to environment, they're significant. Talk about those, because they called it the toxic donut because of the industry that essentially donutted this community.
Mm-hmm.
This, you lived it. What are some of the things that affected the people that live here?
See, you can see my screensaver.
Yeah.
This is my inspiration every day. And this is why you call it the toxic donut. This is Altgeld Gardens. This is sewage treatment facility. These are all the hazardous material surrounding us. So this demonstrates this is a toxic donut with the industry.
Right.
And it teaches me and inspires me that all this got to be cleaned up. It may not happen in my lifetime, but we need to set the roadmap to achieve environmental cleanup in this country. Because if you look at this, industries, look at all the waterways, air, water, and land. And we need to get universities, government, communities, and businesses together to see how we can resolve some of these environmental harms that we have in our community, because it depends on our future.
Can you see and feel and taste and smell living in what is called a toxic donut?
Yeah. Especially when it comes to air quality issues. It was unbearable at one particular time. You knew when you coming down the Bishop Ford Expressway that you coming towards Altgeld Gardens because the smell was that horrible. We used to have like 325,000 pounds of pollutants emitted to our air every day. I think it's down to like less than 100,000 pounds. That's a significant improvement. You see that more business in this area is looking at things from a green perspective in opposed to what is all about the dollars at the end of the day. So I can't never say that, right? never say that. But it's to enhance the quality of life because we have learned. We have technology. We have more information than we ever have to try to correct some of the mistakes that we have made in the past. And, you know, it's just like even growing. Are you the same size when you was born?
No.
You know, so we have to change. So change is inevitable.
Right.
And we have to be adamant about protecting our air, protecting our water, and protecting the land that we live, work, and play on. There's no compromise to that anymore. Because if it is, then we see the results. We see the mass destruction that is going on. Mm-hmm. And it's because of us as humans.
You know, I think about the challenges because, for instance, I think of so many people who probably were flabbergasted or possibly shocked or stunned about the situation in Flint, Michigan with water, where the water was contaminated and people just can't understand why that was not fixed.
You know, one of the things I say about that was very criminal. And if you knew that this water is contaminated for the whole village, the city, whatever they call itself, yeah, you knew that. And you didn't try to make a change in that, that's criminal. Because one speck of that water could damage a kid for the rest of their lives. You know what I mean?
So I do,
Not, you know, not to try to correct that. Because government has a responsibility. Because if they didn't have the funding locally, the federal government folks that came in and did some intervention and put mm-hmm. some resources, that's what our tax is about. But we didn't holler about those things, you know. There's a lot of Flint, Michigan neighborhoods around this country because we have to deal with the old infrastructure of the leaded pipes. You know, now that we know. And what's wrong with I would pay the extra tax if I know it's going to deal, especially with the infrastructure problem we have with our drinking water, what's coming into our homes. There's no compromise for that because it's irreversible damage once you are damaged. So why not tax? You could tax me. I'm the poorest you can tax, but I'm willing to pay that extra tax. Tax these industries.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about the bottom line. It's about the quality of life.
I always think
be fruitful as much as possible without putting harm in
you so eloquently say about, you know, just one drop of that water or exposure to some of these things is irreversible. And I look, just sitting in your office here in Elk Hill Gardens, I see the pictures of kids and playing in the playground, and I think about knowing what kind of contaminants are in the soil here, what kind of contaminants are from the landfill, from the sewage plant, from the surrounding area. Do you think about the fact that even in your own words, talking about one drop or irreversible, the mm-hmm. impact that some of this environmental chaos has had on your community.
And that's why it's so important for us to try to be on top of our game. But because of our limited human resources to be able and not having the ability to hire the scientists that we need to help bag up that information is one of our big barriers. But to make sure that these industries are in compliance with the permits that make them operate, that's where we have a voice. And to exercise those voices. But it's really difficulty. So the best thing to do is put it out there in the public and awareness. Let people know. You have a right to know if there's an industry next door to your house. You have the right to know how they operate. You don't have no rights to their business, how they make their money.
Right.
But at the end of the day, you have a right to know about their processes and the chemicals they use. You know, like Sterigenic.
Yeah.
And that goes back to not having a lot of independent inspectors from the government, because somebody skipped a beat on that.
Or cut a budget.
From the county, right, from the federal, from the state, to allow them to say when they have too much emissions in the facility, open up the doors there, or let it go down in the sewer system. That's criminal. And we need to prosecute industry that do criminal behavior, because what you do, look, all those people in that neighborhood got cancer.
And I hear what you're saying. It's different between what's criminal and what's maybe ignorant, not knowing what your product
not
is doing.
Knowing.
Yeah, and that's really the balance. Because you could say that the industries that have surrounded this neighborhood for
years. But not when
years,
we got a scientific review board that reviewed this
right,
stuff.
Right.
You know what I mean? We're supposed to be the best in the country. Come on. Ain't no excuses. These people are looking at the end of the day how much money I can make, and people wants to dirty up, don't want to pay to clean it up or to manage their stuff. They rather do illegal dumping than to pay the tipping fee to do it. Come on now. You know you're doing something. I mean, there's no excuse for that.
Right.
Do what is right, because what you're doing at that moment is going to have a lifetime impact on somebody or this or that neighborhood or that community. Because how do we clean it up? Pollution don't go to heaven, y'all. Right? So whatever goes up, comes down, is in our soil, is in our water. Look at the triple effects that they're doing when they do this stuff. And we can't have no excuses for them. But our government got to be strong like that. And that's why I believe in campaign reform. Corporations should not be financing any of our political processes.
Right. For you to be in this office in Altgeld Gardens and to be affecting change, you're talking about the solar energy, the panels that are coming in here, you're bringing renewable energy and mm-hmm. clean energy to the Altgeld Gardens area. This really comes from you. It comes from the people in this community that have stood up and said, we want change. We don't want another industry to come into these vacant lots, these abandoned lots. How does that make you feel to know that you are doing something good for your community?
You know, it's a war with many battles. It has its ups and its downs. But I'm committed. You know, and I would like to see, because what we do out here have an impact on this whole city, if not this state. It's not this country. We need to have community scientists who's out here working with industry. We need to partner with this stuff because at the end of the day, they're my neighbors. So how are we going to get along? Can we get along? Do you want to get along? And then the saddest thing that I hate about it the most is many of these industries are being subsidized by government. So you getting
money.
Resources.
Yeah, right.
And you still don't want to do the right thing? Come on, man. I mean, that's wrong. That's morally wrong. And I don't know what level of the law that is, but it's morally wrong for you to even do anything like that. We subsidize a lot of corporate America to do the right thing, and they still don't.
Cheryl Johnson, I can't thank you enough for letting us come down and talk to you here in your office, and good luck, and we can't wait to see the solar panels.
Yeah, we're trying to make our community one of the first solar community. It only takes 3 megawatts to power up our community. We're proposing to do 10 so that we can assist our adjacent neighborhood and whatever residual we have left, work with ComEd, be a good neighbor, and buy our assets so that we can support programs for the community, help community get back to cooperative businesses in our community so where residents can feel good and have ownership. And so we can beat the perception that people in public housing just dependent on government. That ain't so true because we, as you see, we try to make our community every day just by looking at my office.
It's inspiring. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Cheryl Johnson's the director of the People for Community Justice at Altgeld Gardens. She'll be speaking on a panel with Bill McKibben and others at the Chicago Humanities Festival coming up on May 4th. More to come here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Coming up, goats. Lots of goats. I think Pete might have snuck a goat out of the Urban Growers Collective farm in South Chicago and taken it home because I keep hearing in the studio. We're going to talk about Urban Growers Collective, urban agriculture in an area in the southeast side of Chicago that you think about. Oh, my, that's the right underneath the Skyway Bridge, right near the old Southworks U.S. Steel. Not a place you would think you would find agriculture and farming. We're going to talk about what Erica Allen and Urban Growers Collective are doing, not just on the south side, but all around the city. That's coming up in the 8 o'clock hour, as well as a conversation about the film Sustainable, which you can find on Netflix right now, which really takes a look at the local food movement, but also industrial agriculture, and we'll talk about that, as well as much, much more. There's so much to do tonight. Keep listening. Extension 720. Thanks, Don. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's Extension 720. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk a little bit about farming and our local food movement. The documentary Sustainable, which is a great documentary, is being screened as part of a mini film fest from the One Earth Film Festival at the Garfield Park Conservatory this weekend. Director Matt Wexler will be here. We'll talk with him about the film, which really both looks at the local food movement, but also explores some of the things that are happening in industrial farming and its impact on the climate change and global warming. We'll have that conversation coming up in just a moment. As I mentioned earlier, the movement to tackle the problems associated with climate change will be led by younger generations. And with the 2020 presidential election right around the corner, there's no doubt that climate change will be front and center in the Democratic primary.
but will it be prioritized? Enter U.S. Youth Climate Strike. The group of young activists are calling on the Democratic presidential candidates to pledge to appear in a debate or a forum specifically on climate change. They've created a petition and over 50,000 people have signed it. So will the candidates listen to the youth of America who want government action now? One of the leaders of the U.S. Youth Climate Strike is right here from Barrington, Illinois. Her name is Anya Sastry, and she joins me on the line now. Anya, welcome to Extension 720.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So why this petition? Why this pledge to have a specific debate about climate change?
Yeah, so at this point, we have environmental issues that are so large and important that it is simply not enough to just have individuals taking action. We need change in policy from the highest level of government that we have. And this is one of the reasons why we need to know what kind of concrete plans each candidate has. And so with this debate, we are going to hold them accountable to a concrete plan, not just a campaign speech. And that is why we were asking for this debate.
And that's interesting because you do have a lot of politicians and a lot of candidates who've gotten in the race who will have position papers or they'll make it part of their platform. But you're absolutely right. Rarely do we see one issue debates. And in this instance, an issue that's so important.
Exactly.
So for you, how did you get involved in this? Because you are from Barrington, Illinois, and this is, of course, a national association and a national movement of young activists. How did you get involved?
Yeah, so I've been a part of youth activism for a few years now, and I think that social media has played a large role in connecting youth from around the country and from around the world. So when the co-founders of our movement posted on social media about starting the U.S. Youth Climate Strike, I contacted them immediately and said, how can I get involved? And so I think the power of social media has played a large role in connecting a lot of people from different places with the movement.
For you personally, what attracts you to the issue of climate change? What is, because there's a lot of different things as an activist you could be involved in and right. really sink your teeth in it. But what is it about climate change that grabs your attention?
I think the moment when I realized how horrible this issue was when the UN released their report saying there was only 11 years left. And it's understandable how saying that there's only 11 years left may seem polarizing or extreme, but ultimately, like, we are speaking the truth when we say that, and we have greenhouse gases polluting the environment, and that's being absorbed by the ocean, and we have these acidic levels in the ocean rising, and we have warming waters and rising sea levels, and ultimately, everyone is going to be impacted by this issue. This is not a Republican or Democratic issue. This is an everyone problem, and so we have to have everyone working to solve it.
You've seen in the last couple months movement in Congress, the new Green Deal or the Green New Deal, which has come out, of course. But there's, you know, as this session motors on, they're in, you know, recess right now. But are you confident that Congress is actually going to take action and that we might see a comprehensive climate change policy from the United States of America?
I think what elected officials have to realize is that when my generation and kids in my generation turn 18, we are going to hold them accountable to whatever promises they're making. So that's why this petition and this debate is so important, because we want candidates, the 2020 candidates, to realize that we are going to hold them accountable to these plans. And, I mean, many elected officials are currently saying that the Green New Deal is radical and not possible. But I think that at the end of the day, this issue is so important that we need to take radical action. And yes, it is economically radical, but I think that one aspect is it's going to create a lot of jobs in the clean energy industry, such as solar and wind, and so it's going to have some economic benefits as well.
Well, there you go. You heard it here as we were talking with Anya Sastry. She is a young youth activist who is part of the U.S. Youth Climate Strike right here from Barrington, Illinois. Where can I sign the petition, Anya?
Yeah, you can go to moveon.org/climate debate.
There you go. Anya, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This is as we said at the beginning of the show, the younger generation seem to be more passionate about accepting radical ideas, and we hope that they will obviously continue that. And this petition, 50,000 people signed already, just to get Democratic candidates to debate a specific issue. That's the part. This isn't brain surgery. This is just getting them on a in front of a podium to talk about one specific issue. Hopefully, they will have success in doing so. When we come back, we'll talk about the new film Sustainable, which is out on Netflix and also part of a film festival that is taking place Earth Week here in Chicago. We'll have that coming up here on Extension 720. Stay with us. Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. If you haven't watched the documentary Sustainable on Netflix, might I suggest that you put it on your list for the weekend? The film looks at the local food movement, about restaurants and stores using locally grown produce from regional farms. But it also looks at the current state of industrial farming and the national food policy. And the outlook is grim. From farm runoff to soil loss to pesticides to meat production, this doc tracks industrial agriculture's impact on climate change. It uses local farmers and researchers to look at how agriculture and food production has to change for us to change. But can it? Will the big business of industrial agriculture change their systems faced with the fear of possibly losing money? Overall, the film is well shot, well directed, and gives a glimmer of hope that there are some ways for us to turn around before we can't turn back. Matt Wexler and Annie Spiker are the creators of Sustainable. It's being shown at the Earth Week Mini Film Fest at the Garfield Park Conservatory on Saturday. Matt will be there for Q&A, and he is my guest tonight on Extension 720. Matt, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
So where's the idea of this documentary come from?
Well, Annie and I are married, and one thing that really brought us together was food. And this idea of going to the farmer's market, I'd actually never been to a farmer's market before I met her. I thought it was a bunch of bull. And I went there and I tasted some of the greatest flavors that I've ever had in my life. You know, springtime asparagus and French breakfast radishes and snap peas, like just flavors I felt deprived. I felt like, how have I been deprived of these amazing flavors for so long, and what's the secret? And then you look up at the signs for all the farms, they say local, organic, sustainable. And I grew up in a world where labels, you know, I was very skeptical about it. So I wasn't going to believe it necessarily. But I was in love with the flavors and I wanted to investigate more about it. So Annie and I set off on this course to really define what it meant to be sustainable within the food system.
And you really did. And you got some great people in the documentary talking about their take, and whether it be chefs or researchers or scientists or farmers. But the film is really about Marty Travis. And Marty Travis is he owns a local farm, and he set up a cooperative to bring local produce to farmers markets, to restaurants, and to stores here in Chicago. Take it from there.
Yeah, well, we went down to Marty's farm on a hunch from a tip that Rick Bayless gave us. We were lucky that Annie had done some editing on his show for so many years. And we went down there thinking, we'll shoot, 3 minutes here, and it'll be nothing, right? Just a little blip on the radar of the whole film. And we ended up staying there way longer than we expected. We kind of just fell in love with his farm and with him and his son and what they were doing. And we came back and we said, this is it. I mean, this is the story right here. And he's doing everything right. He's doing stuff that nobody's doing. And we have to establish the story from here and go from there.
It really was. I mean, it almost flies in the face of what we know about farming. When you're watching Marty and his family, his very small family, his son and his wife, and what he does with the harvest and putting them in the vans and driving up from Central Illinois all the way into Chicago. Great shots of the skyline and the traffic and going to all the restaurants and conversing with some of the award-winning chefs, from Stephanie Iser to Rick Bayless, about, this is what I have, this is what I'm going to give you. It really, it changed the way I thought about farming in this state.
Yeah, I mean, when Bon Appetit named Chicago the best food city in 2016, I believe it was, a large part of it is because of people like Marty, who helped to really pioneer this local food movement and worked with some of the greatest chefs that had an immense amount of talent and were just looking for those flavors to add to their menus. And, I remember the first time I went to Girl and the Goat and had the green beans off of Stephanie's menu. And I said, these are the best green beans I've ever had. Turns out they were Marty's green beans. Turned out they're a variety of green beans called Empress green beans. And that really gets into this whole idea that it's not just about growing the generic green bean. Mm-hmm. It's about growing a variety that's fundamentally full of flavor. Maybe a little bit harder to grow.
Yeah, but that's really the crux of it. It may be a little bit harder to grow, and I think that people who might be listening right now say, and also it might be a little bit more expensive to harvest and to put on plates in Chicago. And your documentary kind of looks at what that means, because you know we all have our stereotypes or what we think of. Well, you know what, Marty, that's going to be If I go to the farmer's market, I'm going to pay double. If I get the organic, it's going to be more. All the kind of things that we go through, your documentary kind of pokes at and starts to unravel some of the things that are stuck in our heads.
Yeah, how could that possibly be the food system of the future, right? But when you look at it and you see that, here's three people who work 160 acres. When I've talked to row crop farmers who need to farm 1,000 acres in order to make a living of $80,000. And think about how many farmers can be put onto the land if you divided that land up into smaller farms like what Marty and his family are doing. And if you developed more connections, not to mention if you incentivized farmers to grow this way through government policies. So, to think that it's impossible to have a food system like that means you don't really necessarily care about your children's future.
Well, that's really what the film Sustainable is about. It's on Netflix now. Matt Wexler is one of the directors, creators, and in studio with me tonight. You know, we make a transition to industrial agriculture, and you go through the history of it, that at one point it was a bunch of rural farms, not unlike what we see with Marty Travis, and corporations came in and said, we double, triple, quadruple, massively expand what we do here, we can make a lot more money. And that sort of became the farming that we know to be U.S. farming, this monster fields and farms and huge processing plants and everything that goes into it. That's what we know to be farming in America.
Yeah, but it didn't go to feed the people it needed to feed. In the late 1960s, the food insecurity was at about 5%. It's now at about 13%, despite the fact that we produce enough food in this world to feed about 10 billion people. And we have about a billion people starving across the world. So this industrialized food is not going to feed the people who need it. And nor is it doing a service to the earth itself. I mean, it's killing our soils. Across the heartland of America, we have the Ogallala Aquifer, which feeds, I believe, 8 states and has about 15 years left of water on it. There are areas that have already dried up. This area used to house 60 to 90 million ruminant animals, buffalo and all sorts of deer and everything else. It was a pasture land, right? And if we can return it to that pasture land, we would go so far in sequestering carbon to reverse climate change effects and also to create a resilient farm system in America that would feed a lot of people.
Matt, as I explore tonight in Extension 720 this concept of climate change and whether or not it can be reversed and also what are some of the challenges, the agriculture system really plays a central part of it, because the land use, and you talk about it in the film, a lot of the waste that industrial farms are putting into our lakes and aquifers and rivers that are heading to the Gulf of Mexico or other places. I mean, these are all the things that tie together why our planet is in disarray right now.
Yes, I mean, why politically we can't see and connect the dots that the food system is the centerpiece for fixing climate change, I'm not totally sure. When you talk about carbon in the atmosphere, you have to talk about where that carbon is going to go. And the likely place, the best place for that carbon to go is back to the soil where it started.
Which is by design.
Right. So if you converted land that used to be pasture back into pasture that is currently being used to grow row crops, corn and beans, you would go very far in sequestering carbon. And there was just a recent report by the Rodale Institute that said if all farms went towards organic practices, it would sequester enough carbon to reverse climate change.
And you mentioned in the film, and I thought this was just such a great point, and I think it was the Rodale Institute talking about the difference between organic and I guess it would be non-organic or industrial.
Yeah.
But there always has been, especially from consumers, this idea that, well, that's more expensive. expensive, or, you know, to do it organic is not efficient. And they debunk it completely, saying these are just words, that if you actually did organic practices and got rid of the pesticides and all the other stuff, you wouldn't even see a difference.
Yeah, I mean, 30-plus years of research, trial, side-by-side trial of organic versus industrialized row crops, and the organic actually does better in years with drought and climate differentials, but is pretty much on par, right on par with the industrial other years.
So why do we have such a... Is it really just industrial?
It's big business.
It's big business.
And, you know, it's farm subsidies, it's old school politics, it's, you know, government structure that has been in place since the 1920s, really since the time when the Green Revolution really started in between the 20s and the 40s. So it's time for a fundamentally new food system, and that is, you know, what we want you to think about when you watch the film Sustainable, that it is possible. It takes really smart people like Marty, but we have this information now, and we have a way of connecting people with the information. We have technology now to get the information in the hands of all these farmers.
Matt Wexler is the director of Sustainable. This film will be screened at the Garfield Park Conservatory this Saturday. He will be on hand for Q&A. It's part of the mini film fest, the Earth Week mini film fest from the One Earth Film Festival. We'll take a quick break, come back, continue our conversation. Matt Wexler and the film Sustainable in studio, Extension 720. Stay with us. Thanks, Tom. Extension 720 here on 720 WG, and I am Justin Kaufman. We're talking about the film Sustainable, which you can find on Netflix. It's also part of the Earth Week mini film fest from the One Earth Film Festival. It's going to be screened on Saturday at the Garfield Park Conservatory in Garfield Park. And Matt Wexler, one of the directors, creators of the film, will be there for a Q&A, and he's in studio tonight. We're talking about this film that really looks at the local food movement, but also explores the history of industrial agriculture. And there's a point where there's this talk in the middle of the, I would say the middle of the 20th century, where there was a need for efficiency in farming, and that's what that really was the push, this efficiency. We're going to mass produce everything from grain to meat to dairy, whatever it might be, but we need more and more to feed. They talked about food insecurity. And really the byproduct was rural America. And if anyone who's living and who's listening in the suburbs or maybe in the city, you may have this thought of the red barn and what rural America is today. And the film looks at industrial agriculture and paints an entirely different picture.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's going on in rural America right now is economic colonization. You know, that's really what's going on. And a Wall Street Journal article pointed out a 5-year decline in the rural population, and that rural America is leading in all poverty statistics. So it's not a pleasant place to live anymore. And you go to a farm like the Marty Travis's farm, Spence Farm, and it's beautiful. But outside of that, it's a really hostile place, and it's difficult for someone who's young, like myself, who would love to move out to the country one day, to find a place where I would feel that I'm safe, where I can grow food for myself, where I wouldn't feel like my rights may be taken away from me from my industrial farming neighbors polluting my water, polluting my air, or making it a hostile environment for me to live in.
There was so much made of bailouts with the tariffs, and we saw with some of the things that just happened with the Trump administration, the continuing fight with China. But now I think about it after watching your film and better understanding agriculture, that the bailout may not have been for mom and pop on their local farm, but really we're talking about a bailout for these industrial agriculture providers who really are working in mass production.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they are technically family farms. They are, but they are very large companies. You know, they are people who are farming thousands and thousands of acres. It's very different from small farms like Marty Travis's. And the thing is that, I mean, when you have a global food economy, and you will have massive collapses of your food system where you need to bail out an entire industry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, and the government has basically bailed out the dairy industry too. They're buying up all the cheese because the dairy industry can't sell it. The dairy industry is in a 25-year decline, something like that. So, and they're counting on the government to help them get out of it. So if you think about how we transition to a better food system, you could talk about spreading people out on the land, rebuilding rural America, at one point in time in the 1930s, 25% of the population in the U.S. lived on over 6 million farms. We have less than 2 million farms now. Less than 2% of our population lives on them. And some studies show that less than 200,000 people actually contribute to our food system today.
There's something about it, too, when we talk about climate change and we talk about how farming and agriculture plays a role in this, that there needs to be a system change. And you kind of mentioned that right before the break, that everyone needs to kind of embrace the idea that there's still money that can be made. But the way we do farming now and the systems now and the waste that obviously is going downriver, just in general, that has to change. And are we seeing the farming community, the agriculture community, step up to the plate on this kind of stuff? Are they saying we recognize that the impact we're having on the planet? Or, like many of the other industries, are they saying, you know what, we're just going to keep doing this till someone says we can't, and then we'll fight to the dickens till we can't?
Right now we're seeing deregulation. That's what we're seeing. Slipped into the 2018 or 2017 U.S. budget was a bill that said that you cannot complain about odors from large concentrated animal feeding operations anymore. So that's what they do. They realize agriculture is not on the radar of people. There has not been a U.S. presidential debate about agriculture since the 1960s. That's a huge problem.
Yeah.
And right now we have, 20 candidates who are all in the state of Iowa, and many of them have participated in conversations about changing our food system. But if that conversation dies in Iowa and it doesn't move on to other states, then nothing is accomplished, and we're back to where we were. And we need to really talk about, how do we rebuild rural America? How do we make it possible for young people to go out there? I talked to one farmer who contributes a lot to the Chicago community, is Greg Gunthorpe. And he has the second largest pasture chicken farm in the entire country. And he was telling me that in his area, they had a referendum on whether or not to continue funding the school there or not, because they don't have enough people to pay taxes to fund that school. And the referendum did not pass, and they no longer will be having school for kids in that neighborhood. They will have to go to the nearest school in the next county. That's really sad.
There are a lot of other things. I mean, obviously we're drawing out some of the controversial parts about the film, but I really enjoyed watching and trying to understand how farming has changed. And one of the areas, and some of the chefs were talking about wheat, that wheat really is the foundation of this country, and we have used wheat to settle and to thrive and to prosper. But somewhere along the line, once again, things changed, and wheat went in a different direction.
Yeah, but just you saying wheat made the hair on my arms stand, because I'm in love with the flavors that come from some of these small farms, some of these varieties that have been brought back by these champions like Greg Wade and Ellen King out in Evanston, yeah, where I live. The flavors that are coming here are amazing. They're working with farmers, some who have converted actually from being traditional.
They're different varietals, right?
Yeah, row crop.
Right, right.
I mean, you're talking about more than 60,000 varieties, I believe, just in the U.S. seed bank alone. And there, thankfully, there are people at University of Illinois now who are doing studies, trials to test these wheats.
And this is important, Matt, because in the film you talk about how the wheat industry, or just the idea of harvesting wheat, they went in a different direction where they said varietals are the enemy.
Yeah. Norman Borlaug won the Nobel Prize for creating the dwarf wheat, which they said at the time was going to feed the world. And what they did in breeding that is they bred out all the protein. They bred out everything that was fundamentally good about wheat was bred out. And now we have this gluten thing going on, which is kind of a byproduct, actually, of the fact that we changed wheat from something that was incredibly healthy to something that is incredibly not healthy. And, 99% of the wheat that's grown in this country is one or two varieties of this dwarf wheat. But that's changing. And they're especially here in the Midwest. And people on the coast, they even talk about it. You have a great bread culture going on in the Midwest.
And I think at the core of that storyline is about, once again, local farmers and local producers deciding to do something different to almost disrupt if you will, the food, the cycle in which we make food. And that's really what this film is about. Sustainable is the film. You can find it on Netflix. I watched it the other night. It was great. It's also a part of the mini film festival as part of the of Earth Week and the One Earth Film Festival. And it's going to be at the Garfield Park Conservatory coming up this Saturday. Matt Wexler will be there doing a Q&A. You can join him there. What time does that start?
I believe it's at 11. Don't quote me on it.
Some time to check your local listings, yeah. Right. Matt, a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming in and looking forward to our next conversation. Appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
It's Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman, and we are continuing with our theme, Who's Going to Save the World? We're talking about the environment, climate change. It's Earth Week here in Chicago. And, of course, we just had a conversation about farming. Both agriculture on the local level and the local food movement, but also industrial agriculture and how it's expanded and it's causing certain problems for climate change. And we have to really take a look at some of the things that are happening in that area before we can really have a real conversation about how to save the planet. One way to save the planet would be to bring agriculture to the urban scape. And that's what we're going to talk about now here in the city of Chicago. We have a lot of urban farms that are popping up here and there, including Urban Growers Collective, which has 7 farms all over the Chicago area, and they partner with many more. A great organization that is not only bringing farming to communities that aren't used to it, but also help creating safe spaces. We went to a factory in South Chicago. Here's our story. It's a sunny afternoon on the southeast side of Chicago, specifically 89th Street and South Lakeshore Drive. The lake is a stone's throw away, and the Skyway Bridge hovers above like a concrete cliff, not to mention the old Southworks steel plant a few blocks up. It's the last place you would find a farm. Or is it? This is urban agriculture at its finest. What once was an empty city lot is now growing kale, forms of bok choy, and home to roosters and goats. Yep, goats. It's one of 7 farms run by Urban Growers Collective, an organization that's not only growing sustainable produce in the inner city, but also creating job opportunities for those inner city communities. Erica Allen has been a mainstay in the urban agriculture movement in Chicago.
I mean, for me, it's really around this idea that we are so disconnected from our food, and that if something happened, what would we do? Where would we? How would we feed ourselves, especially in our most vulnerable communities that don't have access to full-service grocery stores or the knowledge of how to grow food? And also taking into account that there is a lot of knowledge, but not a lot of spaces like this that people can really come out and grow food and, you know, take care of themselves and their family and earn money.
And it's beyond just the idea that I think a lot of people have heard about when it comes to food deserts and nutrition in areas that may be affected by poverty. It's beyond that, because as you just mentioned, the ability to create safe spaces is something that rarely gets talked about when you talk about malnutrition or the lack of resources in communities.
Correct. So this idea of shifting our consciousness from food desert to food apartheid. So this idea that we sort of assume when we have some privilege that everyone kind of has access. We know people are poor or have less than us, and people have more than us. But this idea that people really, within their, you know, like within walking distance, within even driving distance, that there's not a full service grocery store, that there's not green verdant spaces, or those spaces are not safe because of conflict that's happening around, you know, gun misuse. I mean, these are things that, you know, that are becoming more, I think people across the city are aware of this, but this is something we've been working on for years, and know that when we create spaces like this, even if they're small, even if they're little pocket gardens, that we impact, there's rings of safety that kind of permeate when youth can come and they can feel safe and they can be creative and let their guard down. They're forming different relationships with themselves, with, you know, their peers, with neighbors, and then of course, like, with the earth.
Allen doesn't have a background in farming. She actually went to the School of the Art Institute and practiced art therapy. On first glance, you would think that that education wouldn't apply, but Erica is using her skills to build a safe, creative space.
This is my work as an artist, so I made a kind of a departure from the traditional studio artist life into really wanting to be a social justice artist. So I'm doing collaborative murals, doing place-based, land-based work that also impacts these larger social issues was something that was of great interest to me as an artist. I have a studio practice, but it's my studio practice, right? It's not, when I make art in my studio, it doesn't impact the world. when we do projects like this, especially creative people, we impact policy. We impact how people see themselves within an environment. And that, to me, is always very interesting. And I also, as a therapist, really wanted to really impact the kind of, the challenges that a lot of the youth and families that I was working with when I first finished my master's around, like, stressors. Like, if you can't pay your bills and you don't have food to feed and you might get evicted, that's really stressful. That you're going to be kind of depressed. You may not be making healthy choices because of that. So what can I do, given my privilege and my education, to impact that?
The business model is pretty simple. Create the safe space for the community, grow food for the community, and sell that food to the community. They have a bus that makes rounds all year to deliver fresh produce. But not unlike larger rural farms, it is a challenge to make ends meet. Laurel Sims is the co-founder and CEO of Finance for Urban Growers.
It's definitely a balance for folks who are really passionate about it. They can definitely grow enough food and be able to sell it and make enough money. Like, they're never going to become rich superstars, but they're definitely going to make enough to sustain themselves. One of the things I like about the program and that we do through Farmers for Chicago and even our teen programs is just learning the entrepreneurial skills behind farming. So even if it's not something you want to do full time, you can always grow some herbs and make tea. And sell that as a product that helps supplement your income. You know, there's different types of passion products that you can do that aren't full-time,
right.
But definitely, I think, you can get your passion and you can make a little money off of them. So I think it's a range.
When you look around the sprawling plot of city land, you see a handful of young men pushing wheelbarrows and digging shovels into the dirt. They're part of a job training portion of Urban Growers, and most of them have never been on a farm, let alone planted their own food. The farm leader, Malcolm Evans, was one of those kids.
I grew up in Cabrini Green Food Desert neighborhood, and they was installing a community garden in my neighborhood. And at that time, it was just trying to figure out what to do or where it could be safe at. So me and my brothers and friends went over to this garden that they was installing and just started helping out, being engaged, and I just stuck with it.
What did you know about it at that point? When you went over there to the garden, did you know how to grow food?
When I went over there to the garden, I didn't know nothing about food, vegetables, or where it came from. I thought everything just came at the grocery store.
If you look back on that experience, you know, as I see you, as we're doing the interviews, I see you, you're in charge, you're the farm leader, you're the guy who's putting this stuff in. Does it blow your mind that you've gone in such a short amount of time from knowing nothing to pretty much knowing everything?
It do. It definitely blows my mind, but it's just like, it's like a patience thing. It's just like being humble and like following your goals. Like, at that time, I'm 10 years old. I ain't really got my mind made up to I want to be a farmer. You know, most people want to fire police officers. And it was just, like, just meeting Erica, just being inspired, like, all the stuff that she doing and her being more like a mother to me than a manager kind of, like, kept me sticking with her. And she told me when I was young, like, follow your dream. Like, if you like doing it, stick around. Like, doing this type of work, you can either, like, for me, like, love it or hate it. And I'm like, I was young. I'm like 10, 11 years old. I'm going to school, getting out of school, like playing in the dirt, you know, messing around with compost worms and just seeing tomatoes grow. And I'm just like, just kept it going. Like, didn't stop. Just kept going and kept going. You know, I went to Wells and graduated and just came straight full to the hill. And now I'm a farm manager for all the farms. And
do
a different program.
Now Malcolm leads the crew, telling him where to go, what to do next. One of the crew members is Jeremiah. Jeremiah just got out of jail for robbery.
It's a good experience. Like, I've been learning a whole lot and getting myself together.
Is it important for you to get it together? I mean, does this help you?
Yes, a lot.
Yeah? How so?
Just staying out of trouble, to be honest.
Yeah?
And keeping my head on straight.
We talked to Erica, we talked to Malcolm and others about this being a safe space.
Yeah,
it's space. It's important for this space is laid out that way to be space. How do you see it?
The same way. I see it as a safe place for people just to, you know, relax their mind and just, you know, just do work, you know. Just be humble about a lot of things. You know?
I would assume it'd be hard. It'd be easy to go back.
Yeah.
You know, like it'd be easy to go back to the streets as opposed to showing up here. And and working in dirt and working and doing the wheelbarrow, so you're going back and forth. Yeah. So what keeps you coming here?
The people that I work with, basically, like the people that I work with, and they keep me coming back. You know, just because they, you know, keep me on my toes or whatever, and they've been through the same thing I've been through. So, you know, I just want to continue coming. That's where we come from.
Do you see yourself, as you learn the skills and you learn how to grow, and do you see yourself having a career in urban farming?
Yeah, I can see myself doing this.
This is just one of the farms that Erica Allen and Urban Growers is involved in. She's a pioneer in recognizing that urban agriculture is more than just tomatoes and carrots. The farm is a special place.
This is public health. It's important to all of us to have growers who have expertise, who can, you know, take care of our food needs, that we're not looking, you know, we can't grow all the food for everybody in Chicago, but we can certainly create these sort of like these safety points where we have people who are carrying that knowledge, who can are also taking care of themselves and their community, and how that creates safety in it. It's a very monetizable endeavor, you know, like if I can, this space here makes all this real estate around us valuable. It's beautiful, it's safe. Why wouldn't I want to live here? And if we think about that and investing in programs that create, you know, job training and restorative justice opportunities and food that makes all of us healthier, that's sort of the next level. How do you kind of magnify this? And I think we're kind of entering that space as a city.
Someday I'll be a farmer working the land. I wish I was a farmer to work with my hands, 'cause it's been too long a ride, too high the fare. Well, I built and climbed a mountain, but it wasn't there. And I've been looking all around, looked everywhere.
Urban Growers Collective, you can find them online. Of course, doing great work in 7 farms in Chicago and partnerships with many others. And keep looking for them in your community soon. All right, coming up, we are continuing our neighborhood tour. We're going to go to Little Village, and then we also are going to talk about innovations on the Chicago River. It's Extension 720 tonight on 720 WGN. This is Extension 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chicago, what a city. A city made up of 77 heartbeats, the neighborhoods. Tonight, we continue our tour. Recently, we went to Pullman and to Rogers Park, so let's head out west, southwest to be precise. It's a Little Village. Little Village is on the southwest side. It's like a little rectangle bordered on the south by I-55 and Ogden to the north. Western is the eastern edge and the train corridors to the west. It's a predominantly Mexican-American community, which has grown in the last few years as the population gets younger. But many know Little Village as an area of industry. It's lined with factories and abandoned lots where factories once stood. And the neighborhood of single-family homes and small businesses almost stands in contrast to the mounds of asphalt that you see along the highway. Politically, Little Village is in transition. The 22nd Ward was run by Ricardo Munoz, but he stepped down, and now Michael Rodriguez is the new boss. But this ward is also known for corruption, as the 22nd Ward and neighboring wards were at the center of Silver Shovel back in the 90s. This was where companies were paying off aldermen to dump industrial waste illegally. And you guessed it, in Little Village. But that was over 20 years ago, and there has been progress. Namely, one of the sites that had the illegal dumping on 27th Street is now a park. And that has a lot to do with my tour guide today. Kim Wasserman grew up in Little Village. She's the executive director of the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, and she's been fighting for her community for years. She picked a place, La Catedral Cafe and Restaurant, on 25th and Christiana. I'm not kidding, this place is the real deal. It was packed, not a table to be spared. We had to sit in the waiting area to have a conversation, but a perfect backdrop to talk about what makes Little Village tick. So, Kim, what do I need to know about Little Village?
Oh my gosh.
What do I need to know?
What do you need to know about Little Village? We're a kick-ass neighborhood. Okay, I mean, there's no other way to put it. Everything we have as a neighborhood, we have had a fight for. And I think it speaks to our heritage, our culture. You are basically coming to the Mexico of the Midwest, right? We're the second largest population of Mexican Americans outside of East Los Angeles, the youngest population in the city of Chicago. We come from a long line of social justice fighters wherever we come from in South America, Mexico, and beyond. And that doesn't change when we come into this neighborhood. We had a fight to get clean air. We had a fight to get parks. Yeah. We had to fight to get our high school, for the love of Pete. Right? We've had to fight for basic services here in our
community. Why? Why do you have to fight for that stuff? You look here. This is a wonderful neighborhood. I mean, we're sitting in here. It's packed. I mean, you would think that there'd be... You wouldn't have to fight for things like schools and parks. Why?
We have to fight for these things because people believe that because we don't speak English or because we're not documented here or because we're poor, that we don't deserve those basic fundamental rights. And it's our position, both as an individual who was born and raised here, but as a mom and as an organizer, that we damn right have those rights, and right. that if we need to fight for them, then so be it. If it takes us 5, 10, 15, 20 years, then so be it.
What would you say would be the number one issue in Little Village that the residents here have to deal with?
I think the number one issue is a lack of their voice and decision-making in the neighborhood. I think, honestly, when you ask the average person on the street what the issues are, they're pretty clear. When you ask them how to fix them, they're pretty clear. The problem becomes the city doesn't want to hear what we have to say about what we want to see in our own neighborhood.
Are you confident with a new mayor and a new city council that you might get more of a voice?
I don't know if confident is a word. I think I'm optimistic. Optimistic, perhaps, is a better word. And so far, this mayor has said that she would deal with aldermanic privilege yep. around certain things, which I think is a good thing. And environmental justice was on her platform paper. So I think that there's optimism. I think there's hope. But the reality is, regardless of who's mayor, we're going to continue to kick ass if we have to. If that's what we need to do. Hopefully, not as much the next 4 years. But like I said, I'm hopeful that they're going to hear reasoning and they're going to hear why our communities need to have a better voice in what happens in our neighborhoods.
Okay, so let's get to environmental justice. Yeah. You, of course, head up the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, LVEJO.
Correct.
So Google Maps is a good example. Mm-hmm. I was coming from downtown, from the mm-hmm. studio downtown. It takes you up 55 and it drops you off at Kedzie mm-hmm. to come up to here. And when you come up that way, you see a lot of industry. You
oh, yeah.
see a lot of vacant lots and industry that is gone. And that might not even be necessarily a Little Village, but it's on the skirts of it.
Correct.
When we talk about environmental justice, you are a neighborhood that is really surrounded
yep.
by a history of industry. Mm-hmm. And that has an impact on the way that you live your life and the air that you breathe and the water that you drink. Let's talk about that, because
yeah.
that's been almost a century in the making. So what are the implications of being a neighborhood tucked in between or surrounded by such industry?
I think there's twofold. One is the legacy. So the legacy of all the industry that was here that left behind toxic sites in our city and in our neighborhood that limit what we can do and build in our neighborhood. And we're told that the only thing that can be there is more industry.
Right.
So we're stuck in this cycle of industry is the only thing that we can have. But secondly, it also sets the tone for new industry coming in. When you saw those vacant lots, a lot of those lots are being transformed into warehouses and trucking depots. And this is a problem because our neighborhood, with all those great statistics that I gave you, also has the second worst air quality in the state of Illinois.
The whole state of Illinois.
The entire state of Illinois, we have the second worst air quality. And what we want folks to understand is that air quality doesn't stop at Western. It doesn't stop at Ogden. It doesn't stop at Cicero. That
right.
is going to impact the entire
right.
city of Chicago.
Right, right, right.
And we want folks to understand that when they do that little click on the button for an Amazon purchase, those trucks are coming from somewhere. Those products are coming from somewhere, and most likely it's going to come from Little Village.
And I've heard this before, that even when we were talking about the Amazon headquarters bids here and everything, that there has been a move to bring industry into Chicago. But you're absolutely right. Where they end up and how that process plays out has an impact on the neighborhood, specifically Little Village. You're right. I mean, that has been an issue for this neighborhood for a long time, the
Absolutely.
Fact that the trucking industry, I mean, you see it on 55.
Absolutely.
And just all of the soot and everything that
Absolutely.
Comes from the diesel and everything that's in there, right?
Absolutely. So you have a huge train yard in Joliet. Those trucks are coming in, and what folks are looking for is that last mile of distribution. So if you already get your package in 24 hours, how can I get it to you even faster than that? And folks don't think about that when they purchase. They don't think about, where are all these trucks coming from? If I get my purchase faster, how close is it actually, and where does that warehouse live? Our coal power plant that we shut down because we wanted clean air is now a proposed 1 million square foot warehouse, something that the city of Chicago has not seen anywhere of its liking. Hundreds of more trucks coming through our neighborhood. That's not the type
What can you do? I mean, is it protest signs and go to the streets? But what can you do to at least bring awareness to the fact that this is a Chicago neighborhood? spread.
One, be on this very lovely radio show right now and let folks know. But two, we tried stopping it at a city level. Our alderman sold us out, just like he sold us out with the coal power plant. He sold us out in this case, but he's retiring. And the new alderman coming in is talking to the fact that his two children have asthma. This is a serious concern for him.
Because that's some of the things we talk about, the implications. It's not just inconvenience or soot in the air.
Absolutely.
You're talking about bronchitis. You're talking any sort of asthma or lung-related respiratory
Absolutely.
Disease.
Absolutely. So the reality is that although this decision has been approved and they can build, they have about another year before they can actually start construction. We plan on fighting like hell over the next year because we didn't fight for we didn't fight for 12 years to shut down that coal power plant to improve our air quality, to take three steps backwards again and have worse air quality. It's already the second worst. And I think that's the most compelling part is how does a city, how does a mayor, how does a department of planning, how do they make a decision to put another warehouse in our neighborhood when their own reports tell them that we have the second worst air quality in the city of Chicago? Where does the health of our children fall into the conversation? Where does the health of our community fall into the conversation? And as a city trying to be green, how does bringing more diesel trucks into our city make us more green? Those are the conversations.
I didn't hear about the diesel trucks on Kedzie on Earth Day, right? that was missed from the Earth Day speeches of the politicians. There has to be a balance here because there's an economic engine that comes with the industry that is along this corridor.
Absolutely.
They've set it up that way. You've got the expressways and, like you said, the train yards. So how do you find that balance when you definitely are advocating for clean air for this community and recognize that that may not only just be about Little Village, but it's about the entire ecosystem of Northern Illinois?
I think it's a twofold answer, honestly. I think the first one is to say we're not against industry. We're not against business. We just want industry and business that does it in a clean and green manner. Why can't we have electrified trucks? Why can't we have more trains versus more trucks in the city of Chicago? And I think the second question for us also becomes our strength as a community isn't just working in a warehouse or driving trucks. Those are not the only things that we're good at. As a neighborhood, we're second behind Michigan Avenue in tax revenue. That's not coming from trucks. That's not coming from warehouses. That's coming from the small businesses and the food economy that we create as a neighborhood.
Right.
We're sitting in an amazing cafe right now that started in Little Village and has grown out to Lincoln Park and other neighborhoods. The city needs to focus on what we do well. And what we do well as a neighborhood is grow food, create food, and have a food economy.
We just talked on the show with Cheryl Johnson down at Altgeld Gardens, and her mom, Hazel Johnson, was... You know, she coined the phrase environmental racism.
Absolutely.
This idea that industry and the government has used racism to put industry and to pollute different neighborhoods. Do you see it that way? Do you
Absolutely.
See the same thing in Little
it's
Village?
It's the exact same thing. Instead of recognizing what we're good at, we're told that, oh, you all are a great job market for warehouses and trucks. Well, why is that our only option? And where are the training programs? There's no training programs associated with those jobs. There are tons of programs in the city called Alco Gardens and Little Village. Tons of job training programs. Learn to do solar. Learn to do this. Learn to do that. But there are no jobs at the end of that line. What we need are actual not just training programs, but jobs and industry that comes into our neighborhood and recognizes that we are 50% under the age of 25. That recognizes that the city of Chicago, I think it's Latinos and African Americans between the age of 16 to 18, 43% are unemployed. Right. So let's talk about how do we actually solve some of the social justice issues in our neighborhood coming.
It's so interesting, too, because here we are in this cafe, which is booming. I mean, we're here in the morning. It's crazy how many people are in here. But when I think of Little Village and you look at this, it doesn't look any different than other neighborhoods around the city. And the question I have for you is I think about, you know, even the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, right? I don't know if I'm going to be talking on this program with the Wrigleyville Environmental Justice Organization or the Lakeview or the Gold Coast or River North. There are reasons that organizations like yours exist in certain neighborhoods because it's not equal. No one's talking about a warehouse on, you know...
A million square foot warehouse in Lincoln Park? No. In fact, in Lincoln Park, they just kicked out the last metal shredder, and guess where they put them? On the southeast side. That is environmental racism at its finest. When the city of Chicago decides that new economic growth can happen on the north side, and new jobs and trainings can happen on the north side, and all those businesses that are dirty and nasty and disgusting can be moved into our neighborhoods, and those are the types of job development that we deserve as low-income communities of color. And what we have to say to those other communities is to say, you're breathing the same air, but you're also exacerbating the situations in our neighborhood, and you're exacerbating why we and you are also breathing nasty air.
You said that the community here is pretty young.
Yes.
And when you think of the next generation, or anyone who might be 20 years old, 21, they have a different look at our climate and climate change and our policy. Are you hopeful? Are you optimistic for your community to fight the next coal plant or the next warehouse or the next industry that gets moved here?
Absolutely, and I think that's what amazes me the most. We haven't been around for 2 years. We've been around for 25 years. For 25 years, we have been kicking the city of Chicago's ass on the environment, and I still probably have another 20 years worth of work to do. So at some point, you got to ask yourself, well, number one, when are they going to learn? I think, honestly, they like getting their butts kicked on a regular basis. That's just going to be me. But I do get excited because for the first time in first of all, our alderman retired. First time in 25 plus years. Number two, we had our first aldermanic debate this past year in our neighborhood, and it was moderated by a woman, a reporter from the neighborhood. Huge. Huge in our neighborhood. So I am excited because I think you saw more folks running, and whereas our current alderman won't deal with the environment, the three candidates who ran all tackled that issue, no problem, in their debate when they spoke. So I am definitely excited about the future of our neighborhood because I think people continue to underestimate us and underestimate where we come from and underestimate what we're willing to do for our neighborhood and for our city.
Kim Wasserman, the executive director of the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization. She's was our tour guide in Little Village. Continue our neighborhood tours here on Extension 720. Next show, we'll get a different neighborhood. Keep going. I love it. That restaurant was jumping. They're dropping a lot of plates, but they were jumping. More to come here on Extension 720. Stay with us. We crisscrossed the city for this show. Down at 130th Street, then over in the southeast side of Chicago. That was Little Village that we just heard, Kim Wasserman. Coming up after the 9:30 news, we're going to go to the north branch of the Chicago River. Talk a little bit about business and innovation and the business of rethinking the Chicago River. Urban Rivers is a not-for-profit organization here in Chicago, and they have a plan for an aquatic park that would be the largest in the world right here in the north branch of the Chicago River. They also have, and I wanted to spend some time talking about, an idea for a trash robot, essentially a Roomba for the river. You'd put a trash robot in the water, and then volunteers would control it from home, almost like, I guess, drones, military drones kind of stuff. But you can go and take a shift and drive the trash robot. I love that idea. Yeah, our guests on the Download in Chicago Business, which is coming up as we talk about innovation on the Chicago River as we continue with our theme tonight about the environment. It's Earth Week. And the name of this episode, Who's Going to Save the World? So that's all. And that's coming up. That'll be our last segment, right? Wow, man. Just blazing through this stuff.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's business.
Yeah.
It's business.
It's time for the Download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. We couldn't have a full show on the environment, climate change, without talking about solutions, and more importantly, innovation. The Chicago River has become the focal point for environmentalists for decades now. The river has been a long sore spot for the city. But in recent years, it's shown a resurgence, mostly because of cleanup efforts and tourism improvements downtown. But Urban Rivers, a nonprofit business that wants to revitalize the Chicago River, thinks it has a way to improve the way the city interacts with the river and, well, cleans it. Think about a Roomba for the river. It's one of their ideas. A trash robot. Another, the Wild Mile. Taking the north branch of the Chicago River and creating the largest aquatic park of its kind in the world. Make no small plans. We caught up with Nick Wesley, the director of Urban Rivers, and Phil Nicodemus, the director of biology, at the river right behind the Whole Foods on Kingsbury on the north side. We talked nature, habitats, and, well, the business of river innovation.
Our vision for what this could be is basically taking the existing infrastructure, these seawalls, these concrete embankments, and adding onto that walkways and gardens to create this floating ecosystem, which you can be a part of, as well as will support the habitat within the city.
It's interesting because you've seen the city really kind of double down on river walks and bringing more population down to the riverside. This would be that kind of idea. Obviously, it's different. If you're downtown, it's not necessarily an aquatic park. It's just sidewalks put up and restaurants. But how would it be different on the North Branch than what we know to be the Riverwalk downtown?
You know, I think that in this area, it kind of has the benefit of being ignored for the most part. You know, you have a lot of industrial buildings which are lining this channel, and that's starting to change. So I think that on the north side, what will make it a little bit different is by focusing on the habitat and using wildlife first as kind of the motivation to what you're doing. And from that, you'll then create a different type of area than you can find anywhere else in the city.
Phil, I want to bring you in to talk about the habitat because, you know, for people who live in Chicago, they may be familiar with birds in this river and maybe a couple of cars at the bottom of the...
Yeah.
But what is the habitat? I mean, when you talk about restoring the habitat or at least maintaining the habitat, what is the habitat here in the Chicago River?
Yeah, so as a lot of people probably are aware, a lot of the Chicago River has been artificially changed throughout the years. We've used it for different purposes, for different reasons throughout our history. The state that it's in now is a very unnatural state for a river. Rivers are usually allowed to wiggle along and meander, and you've got pockets of fast current and slow current. You've got these different environmental conditions that make it really easy to support a lot of diverse wildlife. In the Chicago River, what we've done is we've flattened the edges, we've taken metallic walls straight down to the bottom, and we've made them bottom very, very silty, mucky, very unsuitable for a lot of different kinds of wildlife. So when you see a lot of seagulls and geese around, understand that's because that's the way we've engineered our system to benefit those species the most. What we're trying to do here is sort of add in more naturalized banks to the river. We're trying to recreate the plant growth that should be there. We're trying to recreate the plant diversity, the insect diversity. All of these things are easy for us to do because all we have to do is add on these little bits of habitat onto a nasty, straight seawall. You get a lot of benefit out of that just because we're putting something there where there's nothing there now.
Yeah, and you know, there's been a lot about bringing the river back in the last decade, maybe even 20 years now. You've seen so much talk about this from even from our government all the way down to Friends of the Chicago River, other places. By just doing the things you're talking about, by changing the way that the river flows, or at least the way that it's set up without the seawalls, you think that would make a major change to the way that we know the Chicago River?
Yeah, so and it's an important point to understand that we're probably never going to get back to the point that we're at. You can't just take a river, destroy it, and then put the pieces back together and expect it to come back alive again. A lot of this is going to take a lot of hard work, and the end result might be something different than what we had before or what we see in other areas, but we can do a lot to improve the situation regardless. You know, if we're just having this empty box here, why not put empty box with habitat? We're not going to get the exact same species. We're not going to get the same abundance of them as we did before or a natural river would have, but it's going to be a lot better than it is now.
Urban rivers, this is interesting because, you know, as we stand here, we're actually in Whole Foods right here in Kingsbury. Kingsbury's had such an interesting life of its own just in the last 20 years. But you're talking about innovation. You're not necessarily talking about restoring habitat, which is the byproduct of it, but you're talking about changing the way the river is through innovation, not just through the Wild Mile, but also through the Trash Bot, which I think is the coolest idea ever, but really finding new ways to bring the river back that maybe hadn't been thought about before.
Yeah, I mean, our cities have to be, we have to find new ways to really engage these rivers in our cities, you know, and this goes throughout the world. They cut through some of the most densely populated areas, and in most cases, the rivers are not really treated with the respect that I think that they deserve as this vital piece of a city's history and future growth. So things like, when we look at what problems they have, we try to find different solutions that will adapt to the urban environment, the trash robot being one of them. We found that we would get an abundance of trash that would fill up this area. And so the first thought was, okay, let's get volunteers together, let's get out there and clean it up. And what we found is the rate that the trash accumulates and the timing was so unpredictable that it was really difficult to have people out there catching it all the time.
So you're talking about like a Roomba for the river.
Exactly, yeah. But a Roomba controlled by actual people on the internet. So people can volunteer to drive this thing for a couple minutes a day to really remove the trash. And so instead of you know, what we do on a daily basis, which is suit up and get into the river, you know, you can just sit from the comfort of your home and volunteer and actually make a difference in the ecology in just a couple minutes.
Ultimately, it's a business in the way that you're trying to bring this innovation to the river. It's a not-for-profit, of course, but most of the river, you know, is owned by different either industry or development or building, or, you know, we're at the Whole Foods right here. How do you get projects like this done when you don't have control of all of the land?
You know, so that's probably the most unique aspect of the Wild Mile, is that you're right. Most of the edges are owned by different property owners. There's a lot of different stakeholders. But, you know, at the end, for the people who own the land around here, it's a value-added piece. You know, when you have a vital park, when you have a really diverse ecosystem, you create a unique space within the Chicago River and within Chicago in general. You know, that makes the area around it better for the property owners and for the residents who live nearby. So convincing property owners comes kind of naturally once they see the benefits and, you know, the little risk that happens when allowing this thing.
I think about the city, because we've seen right here, just north of here, all the talk about Lincoln Yards along the river. Obviously, the mayor's, the outgoing mayor's crowning achievement has been the Riverwalk and what he's done. But the government seems to take on these projects. So is there a way that this is something that should be done by the city and the municipality as opposed to a private company?
Well, we're working with the city Department of Planning Development on the Wild Mile. So doing the floating education platform, which will be something that should come online later this summer. It's a project that's done in collaboration with them, where we're actually bringing people down to the river's edge and allowing people to kind of experience the river from the river level. So I think that the city's involvement, you know, it's just going to increase. I mean, they see the river as a really underutilized asset, and a lot of forward-thinking people at the city are making steps and moving towards really developing these spaces into unique public areas.
And Phil, why the Chicago River? There's a lot of waterways. Why the Chicago River? Why do this downtown?
Yeah, well, so the urban, interurban spaces are kind of some of the areas that are the most starved for natural areas. And what is really unique about the Chicago River is it runs north side, south side. It's pretty prominent throughout our city. It's actually, if we set it up as sort of a natural corridor throughout our area, we can start to utilize it not only as an ecological resource. And it's true that, you know, if you were managing whole watersheds, you could have a bigger impact. But the amount of people that are here and are able to see this and touch this and get in tune with this makes a much more persuasive case for conservation in many other places. So I think that conservation in urban areas can make a surprisingly large impact. I think we're finding more and more. Not only that, it also gets the people in the city who might not experience nature all the time that exposure and gets them to want to experience more, expand more, conserve more in other areas.
For you, Nick, just in Chicago has seen in the last year's time talk about an Amazon bid, talk about a Lincoln Yards bid, talk about a 78 along the river. Is Chicago open for innovation, for new ideas, when it seems like all the new ideas that get thrown out seems to have some sort of controversy around it?
You know, I think so. So far, the response to the Wild Mile has been outstanding. And I think that people in both the city and residents see the value in taking one of these underutilized assets and turning it into something really beautiful for, you know, people and habitat alike. So I think that, you know, when done right, people love it. And I think that this type of installation is just going to spread to other parts of our river and other rivers in general.
There you go. On the north branch of the Chicago River, right at Kingsbury, behind the Whole Foods, right in that North Avenue area complex on the north side of Chicago. That was Nick Wesley and Phil Nicodemus from Urban Rivers. You can find, they're actually having a meeting tonight about the Wild Mile, and they're continuing to have more community involvement and engagement. You can find out all the information at Urban Rivers, the website. Just look it up on Google. You can also find they have some community engagement, including some community events this weekend, doing some cleanup on the river, and you can go out and you can be a part of it. There you go. So that's the story of the Roomba on the river. I love it. I'm in. I think that's the greatest idea ever. I'd sign up all day. Just if I had to have two joysticks, like I'd be able to sit there, and then my wife would be like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm driving the trash bot." I would do it. More to come on Extension 720.
back to Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
Exploring climate change. Who will save the world? Now that we got that out of the way, we can focus on the main issues, like who truly saves the world in Avengers Endgame. There are a couple other stories that we didn't get to. I really enjoy, you know, I hate not being on the air. I know Pete feels the same way. I know that we get preempted a lot because of White Sox baseball. I'm some White Sox baseball fan. I'm glad because I get to be home to watch it. But I do miss, you know, being in the chair and being able to talk to you and converse on the text line and otherwise. 312-981-7200. But there are so... One of the positives about it is to get the opportunity to think about and be thoughtful about the stuff that we talk about. When you're doing a daily talk show, and we've done it with The Download and also with Steve's show in the morning, there's a lot that you go with the flow and you just keep, you know, it is a cycle. It's a grind. And sometimes you don't get the opportunity to go to Altgeld Gardens to talk with Cheryl Johnson or to go out and interview a goat like we did with the Urban Growers Collective. Or to have the conversation we just had right on the Chicago River. And I think that is what we're given, the opportunity to do some interesting things because we have more time. We recorded all of the things that you heard tonight in this program over the last 3 days. Pete and I both came back from spring break on Monday, and there was a list of ideas, one of which, Ted Fishman had a great article in Chicago Magazine. This was a year ago. About whether or not Chicago is poised to capitalize on climate change. We hear this all the time with obviously Lake Michigan and fresh water. This will be the place people go when the planet runs out of water. Or will we be victims of climate change, flooding, and the lake actually rising, and Chicagoans have to move or having to relocate the city? It's a great discussion where some scientists on one side say one thing, and scientists on the other say the other. That's one thing we didn't get a chance to converse about tonight. The other is there was and this is more of a news story, just in the last month, the governors of the Great Lakes region got together for a climate change summit. And the one thing that doesn't get mentioned is that when the White House wants to cut the budget to things like the EPA, the real statement they're making is that they want the states to pick it up. And we have had a mixed bag when it comes to the states coming together as one to be one Great Lakes region, as opposed to governors that politically can't get along. And we had it in Chicago. We had it actually in the last 10 years. There's been such a mix of Democrats and Republicans that no one really saw eye to eye. And now you have this moment in the Great Lakes where you have Evers in Wisconsin, Pritzker in Illinois, the continuing governor in Indiana and Michigan, but Michigan changed over. But this idea where climate change and protecting the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes region has become a consistent or connected priority. There's not one holdout who's like, meh, you know. So that's an interesting, that to have a regional summit like that and to actually pick up the mantle and say we are going to protect what we have in the Great Lakes region or find out how we can fight back against climate change without the help of the federal government, that, or at least be a unified voice to go lobby the federal government. That's a great little story. And then continue. The other story that we're going to do these stories, and that's, obviously we're limited time because we're preempted a lot. But the story of Foxconn, and this is the story about the manufacturing, the electronics manufacturing company from China that was given a pretty sweetheart deal to open up a new factory in Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, southeastern Wisconsin. And the goal, obviously, there's been so much made politically over the benefits package that the former governor, Scott Walker, gave to Foxconn. It was a sweet, sweet deal. And whether or not that will ever come to fruition and if the Wisconsin taxpayers are ever going to see bang for their buck when it comes to jobs and what's offered. All that aside, a one of the issues that comes to regulation and the environment, where they're going to be using a ton of water. They want access to Lake Michigan. They want to use a lot of water just to be able to cool and be able to use the water for their own materials to help with building screens and digital products, things like that. But they're also talking about building on the wetlands and filling in the wetlands. And there was a survey done by the city of Gurnee, which shares the Des Plaines River with where Foxconn, just 20, 25 miles, I think it's Pleasant Prairie. I forgot the name of the town that Wisconsin is in. But the idea that they're sharing that. And so a survey came out saying, hey, this is actually going to cause flooding downriver in the Des Plaines River into the city of Gurnee, not unlike what they experienced 2 years ago. If you remember the catastrophic flooding they had in not just the low-lying riverbed areas of that town, that actually hit a lot of downtown Gurnee. And this study came out and said, you know, you can expect 2 inches more of rising water in the Des Plaines River because of Foxconn, maybe even more, maybe up to 6 to 8 inches more. I don't know how, as a community, you handle the fact that you, because of another state giving a sweetheart deal to a factory, you're going to see 8 inches of water coming down your way. That's on my radar, and I want to go up with one when we have the opportunity, and we will, to go up and talk to Gurnee and explore that top and explore, because I really enjoyed the mayor and the city managers and the study. They didn't necessarily just rattle the saber or just kind of talk about how screwed they are. They started to talk pragmatically about how their community is going to take that out and how what they need to do right now to get ready for that oncoming threat. And so that'll be another story that I'd like to talk to, because you can't fit them all in. There's a lot of stuff tonight. We had to interview the goat. That probably was my favorite part of the show, as being in that South Chicago farm and watching Pete put a microphone towards a goat. And Erica Allen, she yelled, I don't know if you heard this, Pete, she yelled out right before you over there, she goes, they'll eat that microphone. They'll eat the top part, the little screen, because it's like foam. And then when you were taping, there were two roosters that were kind of by your feet. And Erica turned to me and she said, the roosters are getting really aggressive. I hope they don't attack him. And I was like, Pete can take it. Pete will be fine. He'll be fine. He's a professional. He's been around roosters before. So luckily they didn't. They didn't eat your microphone, nor did they attack you in any form. So I guess that's a win. Anyway, that's Extension 720 tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up next here on 720 WGN.